Well, welcome everyone to another edition of the NatCon Australia podcast. Today I speak with Avik Roy, who is a US conservative commentator, activist, and founder of the think tank, the Foundation for Research on Equal Opportunity. Avik has particular expertise in healthcare reform and advised Mitt Romney and other Republican presidential candidates in this area. He's also been a prominent critic of the national conservative movement and was instrumental in pulling together something called the Freedom Conservative Statement of Principles, which we'll discuss in more depth. We briefly talked about healthcare in the United States and his view about what appointments such as RFK Jr. and Jay Bhattacharya might mean. We then get into the NatCon Freedom Conservative debate, his views on J.D. Vance, Trump, and some of the key areas such as trade, foreign policy, and immigration, where NatCons and his Freedom Cons have different approaches. I think you'll enjoy our discussion. Well, welcome, Avik Roy, to the NatCon Australia podcast. I'm glad you can make it.
Thanks, Dan. How are you?
I'm not too bad. It's early here in Australia. We will get into the National Conservative and Freedom Conservative debate in due course. But I thought before we did that, I'd ask you a few questions regarding healthcare in the United States, because that's an area where I think you first rose to prominence on National Review Online and other areas. It strikes me from a distance that, you know, Obamacare and repealing and replacing and amending that didn't quite have the same prominence in this presidential election cycle than it did in previous ones. Is that correct, or was it just?
Well, in 2016. Repealing and replacing Obamacare was a something that Republicans campaigned on up and down the ballot. And Trump promised in 2016 that he had a big and beautiful plan that would cover everybody and that he believed in universal coverage and that he would take care of all his people and that was something he wanted to do. He actually, I think, cited the Australian healthcare system as a model. He particularly cited the Scottish healthcare system, which was concerning to many Republicans because the Scottish system is a socialized one. But he talked a lot about healthcare, claimed that he would have a great plan. And then when he got elected, and Republicans also took both the House and the Senate that year, the Congress went to work on developing a plan. They developed the plan, not the White House. And it didn't work. The bill that they generated didn't pass the Senate. And not only that, but one big procedural complexity that Republicans were dealing with is that there are 100 senators, and there are certain pieces of legislation you can pass with a simple majority of 50 plus one. And there are other, most legislation, you need 60 votes to overcome a filibuster to pass the Senate. And Republicans didn't have 60 votes. They had, I think, 53 or something like that. And so there was a lot of Obamacare that they couldn't actually repeal and replace because they didn't have 60 votes. Democrats did have 60 votes in 2010 when they, for a brief period of time, when they did pass the original law. So that created some complexity, and Republicans really didn't think rigorously about how to overcome that problem. Paul Ryan in particular, I think, he was focused on the House side, and the House didn't have that problem, so he didn't so much worry about what happened in the Senate. And I think that just created a lot of problems. And so Republicans didn't have their ducks in a row, and the bill went down, and they lost. They believe, and polls indicate that they lost Congress in 2018 because the worst thing you can do in politics is to promise to do something that is politically controversial and fail to do it, because you get all the downside for having tried to do the controversial thing, but none of the upside for actually reforming the system in a positive way. So they had the worst of both worlds. They failed to enact the policy, but they got blamed for trying to enact the policy, and they lost in 2018. And ever since, Republicans have basically come to the conclusion that healthcare is too complicated, it's too politically dangerous, and so we should focus on issues where we are more comfortable, like keeping out immigrants and cutting taxes.
So where are we now then? I mean, do they not focus on it in the last presidential election simply because there were other much more kind of controversial things, or are people gradually getting used to Obamacare with its variations and somehow muddling through, or is it something that, or is it a problem which will need to be addressed in due course?
Oh, it's definitely the latter. Healthcare prices, both whether it's the underlying cost of care or the cost of health insurance, continues to rise at a faster pace than inflation, and inflation hasn't exactly been low. And it's the biggest single threat to American living standards. If you actually take into account the rising cost of healthcare in the United States, incomes for the median household have not increased really at all in the past quarter century. So if you actually look at what the median household earned in 2000 and what the median household earns today, and you factor in conventional inflation and also the increasing out-of-pocket exposure to healthcare costs, the total increase in median household income over that 24-year period is about 3.5%, meaning 0.15% a year. So basically nothing. So families are working harder than ever, and they're not earning any more money. And that's a big problem. So that's one side of the problem with healthcare. The other side of the problem with healthcare is the fiscal side. So the debt and deficit that we have in the United States is primarily driven by two factors. One, the rising cost of interest on the debt is now a big issue as interest rates have risen. And the other is the rising cost of government healthcare programs. Believe it or not, and this is a surprising fact both for Americans and non-Americans, the United States actually spends more money per capita subsidizing healthcare than any other country in the world by a wide margin, way more than Australia spends. And yet we have tens of millions of people who either are either uninsured or struggling to afford their healthcare bills. Why is that? It's because the underlying cost of healthcare is so high that the cost of subsidizing healthcare is also incredibly high. So that's why I dropped out of Wall Street to try to solve this problem, because I thought nobody else was working out of the way I wanted to, and I felt it was an important way to spend my time.
Yeah, it seems like it's something that fiscal reality and will eventually require be addressed one way or another. I mean, health did feature in the last presidential debate, but Make America Healthy Again and Jay Bhattacharya and vaccines and the wash up from COVID, right? More than the actual system itself. At least that was the impression I got. What do you think of the nominations of Robert Kennedy and to be head of the Department of Health and Human Services and Jay Bhattacharya to be head of the Department of National Institute for Health?
Well, there's a whole coterie of appointments to talk about. That would be sort of that's an incomplete list. So there's RFK Jr. as the Secretary of Health and Human Services. There's the Deputy Secretary, Jim O'Neill. There's the nominee for FDA Commissioner, a guy named Marty McCary. And there's Jay Bhattacharya at the National Institutes of Health. I'm blanking on the nominee for Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services. Mehmet Oz. A former Senate candidate from Pennsylvania who also used to run a popular television show on health in the U.S. Called Dr. Oz. So there's quite a few people who, the full slate of senior posts in healthcare have been announced. Obviously, they still have to be confirmed by the Senate for the most part. But I would say that particularly that second tier, the people who are maybe not as famous as RFK Jr., but who will occupy very important posts in terms of important government agencies, they're very, very strong, inspire even appointments. I'm less excited about RFK as HHS secretary because the things that RFK is strongest at are not actually the things HHS does. So his great passion, his great strength in terms of like where he spends a lot of his time in a way that is exciting a lot of people is on things like nutrition, diet, and exercise. This kind of MAHA thing, as you mentioned. And the job that he should have to really do something about that is the U.S. Department of Agriculture, the USDA, because that's a job where he could spend a lot of time thinking about the food supply and other ways in which, you know, the food supply in America and the way we regulate and subsidize agriculture may be distorting Americans' nutrition. That would be a great job for him. But I think what happened was, you know, he made a deal with Trump where Trump said, if you endorse me for president, I'll give you whatever job you want. And he asked for HHS secretary and he got it. Trump is a guy who keeps his deals. But HHS is a very different job. HHS secretary is the guy who's responsible for running these multi-trillion dollar government health programs like Medicare and Medicaid, which provide health insurance to the elderly and the poor, respectively, along with Obamacare. And those are very complex, very large programs that require good governance. I mean, in order to, particularly if you're a conservative who wants to reform those programs in a more conservative direction, you got to really have a lot of expertise to do that. You have to know how HHS works. You have to know how the programs work. And Kennedy has none of that. Now, the good news is a lot of the people that are being nominated to serve under him in that second layer of senior positions, they do have that knowledge. And so that's all to the good. But, you know, leadership really matters. And I just think it means that over the next 4 years, if he serves the full 4 years, we're not going to see a lot of real reform of those huge programs that are, as I mentioned, the key drivers of our debt and deficit, which is, in my view, the single greatest problem that the United States faces, is the fact that over the next 20 years, we are almost certain to have a massive fiscal, monetary, and economic crisis because of the size and growth rate of our federal debt.
Yeah. Well, what you've touched on it a bit, but what can we Americans realistically expect then in terms of health reform over the next 4 years, apart from, you know, talk about and changes, I guess, to nutrition and encouraging people to live healthily and no doubt a cleanup in the National Institutes for Health and other agencies. But is there going to be legislative action in Congress to change the legacy of Obamacare, or is that just something that's not really on the horizon in your view?
Dramatic legislative reform in this Congress is highly unlikely because in the House, Republicans have a one-seat majority. They had a three-seat majority, but then Trump decided to appoint two members of the House to senior positions in his administration, which means he'll go from 3-1. And you can't really do anything remotely controversial. You can't even do uncontroversial things with a one-vote majority in the Republican Party of today, where there are a lot of freelancing, heterodox members who, you know, who don't like to be, they're cats who refuse to be herded, let's say. So it's a big problem, and so you're not going to touch anything related to healthcare because everybody has an opinion about healthcare, and their opinions are not uniform. So I don't see Congress doing anything meaningful. I do think that there's opportunities on the margins for the Trump administration to do things through the executive branch. So, for example, you mentioned Jay Bhattacharya. I think there's some opportunities to improve the way the National Institutes of Health operate. So just for those Australians who don't know what the NIH is, it's basically the agency that funds academic scientific research in healthcare. And it's a big engine of the U.S. economy. A lot of the biotech companies that have become very large, and a lot of the medical innovations that the U.S. has led the development of come out of academic research funded by the NIH. Mm-hmm. But the big controversy of the COVID years was that Anthony Fauci, who was a senior official at NIH, he didn't run NIH, but he ran the infectious disease sub-agency within NIH. The fact that he was suppressing Jay Bhattacharya, among others, and politicizing the agency to a degree was a source of great frustration. And so Jay being able to fix that and also maybe reform the NIH in ways that make it more pro-innovation, pro-creativity, pro-non-consensus ideas, I think that would be good for the scientific process in the U.S. So that's good. you know, but that doesn't, you know, that's a great thing to do. It's better than the status quo. But again, the emergency, the urgent problem that for my kids is going to define their existence is whether or not America goes bankrupt or not. And something like that is not going to make a difference on that front.
Right. It's such an incredibly massive topic, healthcare, and you can get sort of bogged down in it endlessly, really. On this, is there a difference when it comes to health policy between national conservatives and freedom cons, in your view?
Well, there may be in Australia, I don't know, but I would say in the U.S., the conservative movement in general has not spent a lot of time thinking about healthcare. You know, the healthcare debate historically has largely been a debate on the left between what you might call the more socialist wing of the left and the more centrist technocratic wing of the left, which says, you know, it doesn't have to be a purely government-run system so long as everybody has access to affordable coverage. It can be private sector driven or it can be public sector driven. We don't care. Whereas for the far left, the Bernie Sanders types of the world in our context, you know, they actually look at it and say the role of the private sector in healthcare is a moral stain on the country, and that should be eliminated because it's immoral for there to be any association with the profit motive in healthcare. That should be eliminated. And the only way to do that is to have the government run everything. That's the view of the far left. Whereas the center left, they look at it like, no, the main thing is we want everyone to have health insurance. It's okay if private sector entities are involved in the delivery of that coverage and care. And if you look around the world, including in Australia, of course, that's how it works, right? There are countries like the UK, which have a largely, if not fully socialized system. But then there are places like Australia where there's a significant role for the private sector in both health insurance and the delivery of care. There's a public system as a safety net, and then there's a private system for people who can afford to opt out and therefore don't have to deal with the queuing and have more choices and more access, right? And there are countries like Switzerland and Germany and the Netherlands where it's basically a universal private system where everyone has health insurance and health insurance is mandatory in most cases, but the delivery of the health insurance is done by private entities and the hospitals and doctors are also privately employed for the most part. So there's a lot of different ways to achieve universal health insurance. And I think the debate in the U.S. is somewhat oversimplified in the sense that you have people who defend the status quo, largely the conservatives. And then you have the socialists who say, let's be socialist like every other country in the world, which is factually inaccurate because not every country in the world is socialist, as I just explained. And instead of thinking about, okay, there are actually ways to reform the U.S. healthcare system that are that actually give Americans what they generally want, which is choice and competition, but the security of a system that will be there for them if misfortune were to befall them. Now, the conservatives in general have not been part of this debate because American conservatives have looked at healthcare as a liberal or left issue. They've seen it as kind of, you know, do I really, it doesn't give me, you know, it doesn't scratch my itches to really provide healthcare to poor people. That's not why I got into politics. You know, that's been the general mindset. It's been more reactionary where liberals or leftists try to do something and then conservatives get up in arms and say that thing you're trying to do is really terrible. Let's oppose that. But in terms of what to oppose it with, meaning what's your alternative, conservatives have split into several camps. And so I wouldn't say that freedom conservatives and national conservatives have a lot of debate about healthcare because conservatives in general don't spend a lot of time talking about healthcare. What I would say in my own personal experience is that I think there are elements of the people on the freedom conservatism side who tend to be much more hardcore about being pro-free market. They tend to be the freedom conservatives historically, you know, let's separate the freedom conservatives of his, the historic variety, the 20th century version, versus what we've been trying to achieve with the freedom conservatism movement of 2023 and beyond, two different things. The historical freedom conservative movement of Bill Buckley and Ronald Reagan and that crowd, they basically looked at it as, this is big government, it's the welfare state, we should repeal the whole thing. I won't say that Reagan believed that. Actually, Reagan had fairly nuanced views about healthcare. He actually believed in universal coverage. He said that if people can't afford health insurance, healthcare in America, we should subsidize it for them. And if we need to subsidize it more, we should. He actually said that in the 60s. But it was Barry Goldwater who was very much antagonistic to the entire any role of the federal government in supporting the subsidy of healthcare for people. And the Goldwater side of things has historically had sway on the freedom conservatism or libertarian-ish tinged side of conservatism. Whereas I think national conservatives in the U.S., to the degree they've opined on healthcare, and most have not, but the ones who have tend to look at and say, look, well, look at Europe. Where's Europe? Where's the rest of the West? There are countries in the rest of the West that seem to have national health care. So why shouldn't we? And I would particularly point to J.D. Vance, who I've engaged with a lot on this topic. J.D. Vance, I think, considers himself a national conservative. And he's a guy who I think of as, he and I are pretty aligned on health care policy. And he's a guy who understands, for example, the role of monopoly power in the U.S. as leading to higher prices and higher costs for patients and consumers. That's a problem that we have to deal with. A lot of the libertarians tend to be against antitrust regulation. They tend to think if you try to break up monopolies, that's a big government. Whereas I think breaking up monopolies leads to more competition. And if you're pro-free market, you should be pro-competition. And I think JD is on my side on that particular topic. So, you know, those are some examples of things that I would say. I would say for myself, you know, people on the more national conservative side who talk about healthcare are more aligned with me personally than probably the more freedom conservative people. But, you know, it's really, you can't really stereotype because everybody has their own opinions about this stuff.
Yeah, I'm you chatting about that reminded me Tony Abbott, who's a former Prime Minister of Australia, used to be a health minister. And one of his advisors told me that his job was basically to make sure health didn't appear in the front pages of the paper. So the conservatives were, whenever they talked about health, they were losing votes. But it's, you know, I think that's sort of not ideal, right? And because it is an issue that affects everyone, and people, conservatives really should be engaged in the way that you are. And again, listening to you talk, it does sort of bring home to me these abstract debates about the NatCon and the FreedomCon stuff are all very good and actually important and interesting, but it is a defect that they haven't tackled in a major sort of serious way, in a way that you have, the detail of health policy. I mean, what do these abstract debates actually mean for a major sector of the US economy, which everyone kind of relies on, in their day-to-day lives? That said, let's tackle this NatCon, FreedomCon debate. How would you describe the nature of the debate? What would you say the NatCon people believe and what you say FreedomCon types offer in the alternative?
Well, first of all, it's important to make two caveats. The first is obviously the debate between FreeCons and NatCons in the U.S. may be very different than it is anywhere else because of the particularities of U.S. history. The other thing is that even within these coalitions, there's a diversity of opinion. So I can only speak from as someone who organized the freedom conservatism effort and the statement of principles. And by the way, there is an effort underway to have an international version of the freedom conservatism statement of principles, which, again, would have to be very different because the one that we've put on our website, freedomconservatism.org, is very specific to the U.S. and the U.S. history and particularly constitutional, the kind of founding tradition of the U.S. But in terms of where the general differences are, I think where probably most people would agree there are differences is that is in that how much you prioritize economic and individual freedom. For freedom conservatisms, economic and individual freedom is really important. It's a first principle, and that ultimately the freedom to live your life the way you want, freedom of conscience to say and think what you believe to be true, to buy the products you want to buy, to have the kind of job you want to have, to raise your children according to your faith. Those things are extremely important to freedom conservatives. The national conservatives, and again, there's a range of opinions, but the national conservatives would say freedom is good, but it must be subsumed to the national interest, and should take kind of second status if freedom threatens the national interest. And I think we all want, you know, the U.S. to succeed. The real conundrum becomes who gets to decide what's in the national interest. And in particular, when it comes to economic freedom, it's economic freedom that is the reason that America is the richest and most powerful and most prosperous country in the history of the world. And the energy on the NatCon side in the U.S. has been to break away from that tradition and say, look, we think that economic freedom is overrated. We got to do A, B, C, and D, and E to suppress economic freedom in the national interest. And the argument from the freedom conservatives, the counter argument, is that actually you're doing things that are counter to the American national interest by suppressing economic freedom. And so, as we talk about in our statement of principles, the thing that actually made America great is economic and individual freedom. And if you are skeptical of the elevation of individual and economic freedom as a first principle, then you're going to actually make America less great. And all you have to do is look at the rest of the industrialized world, which is not growing and prospering the way the U.S. is, because primarily there's less economic and individual freedom in those places.
Yeah. Sometimes I'm struck reading through the different online debates on this, that while they give the names given NatCon and FreedomCon and the like, what people are debating, the labels people are using to debate things now, really, is there that much of a difference between the old debate between traditional philosophical conservatism and classical liberalism? Isn't that essentially what we're talking about with new labels? Wouldn't this be something that Disraeli and Gladstone recognized, this debate we're having?
Yes, I think they would recognize the debate. I do think there are some subtle but important differences, which is I think the core philosophical debate is pretty similar. I agree with you. But I do think there are some important differences. One is, of course, in the U.S., what is the tradition we are trying to conserve, right? The paradox of America is that America's tradition is liberalism, right? And so we're not a blood and soil country that was that is defined by an ethnicity or a race the way, say, Denmark is. And so there's a different form of conservatism that occurs in a place where there really is a relationship between countrymen that's based on kinship and genetic relationship versus one whose motto, unofficially or officially, is e pluribus unum, out of many one, and where pluralism is literally written into the founding documents of the country. So that's an important difference between, say, the Disraeli Gladstone debate and the debate in the U.S. The national conservatives are, in a sense, trying to import a Western European tradition into the U.S., where it is not traditional, in fact, to have that kind of mindset. So there's a bit of paradox there. That's one element of it. And the other element of it, I'd say, is that freedom conservatism isn't merely classical liberalism. It is, at its core, classical liberalism. But there's some really important elements to what we put in the statement of principles that are, you could say, modernizations of or departures from 18th century classical liberalism. it might be more like 19th century liberalism, which is to say, for example, in three different places in the document, which again you can find on freedomconservatism.org, we use the phrase "we commit," and the things we commit to are not standard issue classical liberalism talking points. So one is we talk about the rise of cronyism and how cronyism has been a real problem in the U.S. The intersection of big corporations and state power in ways that have screwed the little guy. And we commit to reforming cronyism so that there's, again, real competition that serves the interests of ordinary Americans and reduces the cost of living. That's something that we commit to. So we commit to reducing the cost of living through classical liberalism, but recognizing, you know, I'd say the pre-2023 free cons, their basic reaction to everything was, okay, if you want to fix the problem of the high cost of healthcare or the high cost of housing, you're probably on the left. You want some government intervention, and we're against that. And the price of housing, the price of healthcare are organic results of the market, and therefore, you know, if housing is too expensive, suck it up and work harder and make more money. And that view ignored the fact that actually the reason why housing is expensive and the reason why healthcare is expensive in America is because of government intervention. Government intervention is the reason why these things are more expensive than they ought to be. And we need to have a positive program in which we use the insights of free markets and classical liberalism to reduce the cost of healthcare and reduce the cost of housing and reduce the cost of university education. And so we commit in the document to that positive program of using the tools of deregulation and classical liberal reform to serve the interests of ordinary people. That's really important because the older version of Goldwaterism just basically said we're against government intervention. It didn't really do anything to try to reform these programs in a politically viable way. So that's commitment number one. Commitment number two is to have a practical and serious and considered program for reducing the federal debt and making it more sustainable, right? It's something we talked about at the outset. That's an incredibly important problem that the national conservatives in their statement of principle don't mention at all. And I would think if there's one thing that should be core to conservatism, it's protect future generations by being responsible. Right. If there's a conservative ethos, surely it is that. And so it's frankly shocking to me that there's no mention of the federal debt in the National Conservative Statement of Principles. And that, to us, that was a pretty important thing to say, hey, we believe that if we are to conserve what America is for future generations, this is a problem we are obligated to invest political capital in solving. So that's commitment number two, which wasn't a problem in 1960 when a previous generation of conservatives got together at Bill Buckley's house in Connecticut and signed the Sharon Statement. So that's something that we felt was really important. And the third thing that we thought was really important to solve or to commit to was a conservative understanding of racial equality. And that doesn't mean equality of outcomes or equality of results, but true equality of opportunity where we say, look, it wasn't merely private racism that leads to the disparities we see today between African Americans and other Americans. If you're a conservative who believes that things that happen in the past can affect the present and the future, surely the Disraeli conservatives would agree with that general principle, then we should understand that centuries of state-sanctioned discrimination against Black Americans could have effects in today's society, and that there are policies that we can enact that address the echoes and the downstream ripple effects of those historical policies. To give one example, we have a system in America where K through 12 education, primary and secondary education, are funded at the local level. And people are very proud of the fact that we have this highly decentralized system of education. The problem with that is that when you layer that on top of a system in which there's racial segregation historically, And so you have Black people growing up in these enclosed, highly impoverished areas where their schools were underfunded relative to other people's schools. And that leads to generational disparities in economic outcomes. Then perhaps a pro-conservative, pro-freedom reform is to say, let's have educational choice. Give parents the money that's being directed instead to the schools and say, we'll give you the money. You choose where you want to go to school. You choose how you want to educate your kids. And then watch the entrepreneurial and competitive system develop new schools to serve those parents. That's a conservative, pro-free market, classical liberal reform that addresses a source of racial disparity and economic inequality of opportunity between Blacks and non-Blacks in America. Right. So the one thing that the national conservatives in their writings have criticized us for is they look at that paragraph in our statement. They say, gosh, that sounds really woke. You guys are woke because you are saying that in the past, America has discriminated against Black people and you're against that. That's really woke. It's like, is that woke or is that just a statement of obvious fact and something that classical liberals should commit to doing something about in a way that is racially neutral, in a way that treats every American equally, irrespective of their race or ethnicity. So those are the three commitments we make that I would argue are departures from what one might read in a foundational text of classical liberalism from the 18th or 19th century that are very important to the relevance and success of classical liberalism in the 21st century.
There's a lot in that. I just want to focus on one of the initial points, maybe gradually tick off some of the others. You used the line, I think, early on that in America, conservatism is conserving the liberal tradition, right? And people in Australia on the center right use that line too. And J.D. Vance, in his acceptance speech at the the Republican convention, famously used the line that America is not just an idea, it's a group of people with a shared history and a common future. It is, in short, a nation. Do you agree with that? Or do you think that America is just an idea and that idea is liberalism writ large?
It's actually a complex topic. I think it's not something you can really it's easy to oversimplify.
I agree.
I think that in J.D.'s acceptance speech, which is worth rewatching if one hasn't seen it, he elaborates on why he believes that. So he says America is not merely an idea. It's also a home. It's also a nation. It's also home. In fact, in other speeches, he said America is not an idea. It's a nation. And that's a line that a lot of national conservatives use. America. One variation of it that Steve Bannon likes is America is not merely an economy. It's a nation. But some people say it's not an idea. It's a nation. And that's fine. I let's have that debate. And then he goes on to talk rhapsodically about the cemetery in Ohio, where a lot of his ancestors are buried, particularly the ones who fought in the Civil War in the 1860s. And I think it's totally appropriate for J.D. to have pride in what his ancestors did to help build America. It's appropriate for all Americans, however long your ancestors have lived in the United States, I think it's appropriate to be grateful to those who helped build the country that we have inherited. Yes, I agree that America is also one's home and that one should defend it and love it because it's our home. But the fact that America is an idea is actually incredibly important. Take someone like myself. So my parents were born in India, or what was then India. It's complex because my dad was born in British India and then it became independent and a lot of hell broke loose after that. But I was born in the United States. And look, I mean, I'm as American as they come. I love the American flag. My favorite sports teams are, you know, the University of Michigan Wolverines football team and the Detroit Red Wings hockey team. Like, these are American or North American sports. It's pretty obvious that I have a completely American accent. You know, I was born in Michigan. You know, like, I've lived my whole life in this country. So is America not a home for me because my parents weren't born in America? Do my parents have had to fought in the Civil War for me to be fully American? The real power of America, the great success of America, the reason why America is, again, the greatest, richest, and most powerful and most prosperous country in the history of the world is because we've had this remarkable ability to say that if you were born in this country, but your parents were not, you are just as American as everyone else. You are an equal partner in the American project. And that's not true in, say, France, where if you read the pages of L'Equipe, the weekly sports newspaper in France, you know, they'll refer to the born in France but of Senegalese ancestry soccer player as Senegalese, not as French, right? The Algerian French soccer player is born in France, but is of Algerian extraction, will be the Algerian soccer player. Of course, when they all play for France in the World Cup, they're all French players. But when they're playing for Paris Saint-Germain or Lyon, you know, they're not. So this is the difference. The reason why you have ghettos and kind of the incredible difficulty in integrating immigrant communities in Europe is because the immigrants in Europe are not seen as French or German or Danish, because the traditions of those countries are much more ethnically driven, right? And I think there's, I think the thing that has made America successful is that we are capable of saying, you know what, someone like me is just as American as someone like my wife, whose ancestry can be traced back to the Mayflower settlers of Plymouth Rock and all that stuff, right? And so, you know, that's an important part of why America's been successful, is that people who don't have lengthy histories in this country can still feel truly American. And because they feel truly American and are accepted as being truly American, they do more for America. In general, in life, as human beings, we do more for things, we invest more in things that we feel we have ownership of. And if we say to people who are more recent arrivals, no, America is not really yours. It belongs to the WASPs, the white Anglo-Saxon Protestants who were here in the 1600s. Well, then you're encouraging them to be detached from their nation. How is that nationalist? If you actually want to bind the people who live in America, who are American citizens, to America, then we should say that all of them are equal partners in the American project. And I don't understand how, whether you're a seventh generation American or a second generation, should play a role in that.
Isn't there sort of a way to muddle through that? I mean, just there's some content, in my view at least, more than simply a bunch of liberal axioms that makes the United States, right? And so I'm just thinking, I have, you know, Irish heritage, you know, the Kennedys from Massachusetts, you know, they fought in the Civil War. The Irish weren't always considered, you know, WASPy.
They certainly were not.
But they, because of their long-term commitment and fighting the Second World War and other things, they certainly, you know, whatever, John F. Kennedy was considered as American as anyone, right? And in fact, it's probably the epitome of what people consider, in many ways, America in the 20th century. But it wasn't simply a question of them just signing, you know, a statement of principles, you know, that there was an acculturation, like yourself, you know, where you grow up and you imbibe, you know, all the different more nuanced aspects of the culture. And isn't that kind of, and it doesn't mean like someone who fought in the Civil War is more of an American on these gradations, but it also means that it's not simply a matter of signing on the dotted line and then you're immediately American. You know, that your understanding and your depth of feeling and emotional attachment to a country does naturally improve with the length of time that you're and your involvement in the country. Isn't there some way to sort of square the circle and isn't that sort of what JD is getting at? There is a tendency. America isn't just a corporation where you're signing on to the statement of values, and you can join IBM or you can join, I don't know, Procter & Gamble or whatever. There's a more of an emotional grounded attachment to a nation state than there is to say a corporation. Is there some common ground there between the Freedom Cons and the NatCons on that, or is there still sort of points where you would depart?
Well, again, I only speak for myself. I don't speak for all freedom conservatives. But I would challenge the premise of your question on two fronts. Okay, so the first is that I actually don't agree that people who are in America for 10 generations are necessarily more attached to America than people who are recent arrivals. Go to any naturalization ceremony for legal immigrants in the United States where people swear their allegiance to the U.S. And witness the incredible emotion, the tears of joy, the incredible pride people have at having worked so hard and spent years of their lives to become American citizens because they believe so strongly, so passionately in what America stands for. You know, you're much more passionate about being American if you have firsthand knowledge of what it's like to not be American. Whereas people who are 10th generation Americans, they have no idea what it's like to be American versus other countries. And I can tell you, I know plenty of WASPs who are very skeptical about America, very critical of America, very dissatisfied with America on a lot of different fronts, often from the left, because they think of America as this terrible country that has all these terrible flaws and, you know, is fundamentally racist and all this other stuff. Whereas it's the immigrants who are like, no, America is this incredible land of opportunity. Only in America could I go from being, you know, someone with nothing, just a suitcase that I carried on the plane, to being incredibly successful. This place is amazing. I could never have done this in the place where I used to live. So it's actually the immigrants who are more passionate about what America is and what America stands for and what Americans' values really are. And the second thing I would say is that, to your point about, well, gosh, you know, can you really be American if you come from this other place with this foreign culture and you don't really aren't really fluent in American culture? Then are you really American? I mean, just if we dig a little deeper in that assertion, so what are we saying? Are we saying that you have to have been a regular watcher of American Idol and an addictive a flipper of your TikTok screen in order to be truly American? Because that's what American culture is today, I have to tell you. You know, American culture is not, you know, reading the poems of Ralph Waldo Emerson and the paintings of Thomas Cole and, you know, reading the Federalist Papers. That's not what happens. That's not American culture in the sense of how people experience it. American culture is popular culture, right? And in fact, immigrants and immigrant communities are more culturally conservative than mainstream American culture is. If you want to find cultural conservatives, you're going to find them much more in particularly Asian American communities than you are going to find them in the communities that J.D. Vance is describing. In fact, in his book, Hillbilly Elegy, he talks quite eloquently writes quite eloquently about how dissolute that hillbilly culture is. And if you compare that to the culture of the Bengali immigrants that I grew up with, which is much more conservative, much more focused on hard work and education and personal responsibility, and then you ask genuinely outside of their accents and maybe the way they dress, who actually is more aligned with what NatCons think is traditional American culture, the Bengalis would win by a factor of 10. And so this whole argument that somehow the people who have been here for 10 generations are custodians of American culture, but the immigrants are not, I just don't see that at all.
Yeah, I just with all these things, there are kind of fantastic stories you can make, but I have Indian and other members of my family as well, but there is an element of the critique from the NatCon side where, not just in America, but other parts of the world, where there has been excessive mass immigration, which has culturally changed a population. And while there may be, you know, hardworking people and traditional types as part of that, there's been, in my view at least, an imprudent openness to immigration, where there should have been a much more of a realization that you can achieve fantastic results with immigration, but it has to be a much more measured and sensible approach, because otherwise, well, in many cases that you've seen in the UK, and no doubt there is areas in the United States too, where immigration has changed areas, and the people who are moving into those areas now aren't, and I'm thinking of the UK, move to areas where then it's no longer English, it's more like a subcultural area of the UK which they don't need to move in and out of. They're speaking not English in many cases. They're not really being exposed to the sort of mores, which is what previous generations of immigrants to the UK and elsewhere were exposed to and signed up for and benefited from. Is it not possible to express criticism about mass immigration while accepting that, you know, you do get benefits from it in other means? Is that not what's driving some of the NatCon sort of critique, you think?
I do think it's driving the NatCon. I mean, well, I'd say mass immigration is driving the NatCon critique. Mm. I think that the critique has some flaws, and some valid points as well, but it has some flaws. And a lot of it depends on, you know, it depends on the country by country context, right? So the Rotherham scandal in the UK, where Pakistani immigrants were raping preteen girls and the police didn't want to do anything about it because they were afraid of being called racist, that is completely appalling. I'm actually a little surprised that that's suddenly become a story, because, you know, I was covering that at Forbes as the policy editor at Forbes 10 years ago. I had Roger Scruton writing articles for me about it. That's completely ridiculous, right? Now, that's very different from the U.S., where we have a lot of illegal immigration, which is a problem just from a rule of law perspective. Illegal immigration, as problematic as it is not changing American culture. Okay, America, the Mexican or the Guatemalan who moves to Texas illegally from Central America is not fundamentally changing America. Like, America is a big country with 330 million people. Even if we incorporate a lot of illegal immigrants, we can absorb, because we're so large, we can absorb a large population of immigrants and not change the culture. That doesn't mean that illegal immigration is good. I'm just saying that just from a factual standpoint, I would challenge national conservatives to point to a specific major cultural, consequential cultural change that is the result of illegal immigration versus elite, highly educated white people moving the country in a culturally left direction at elite institutions like Harvard and Yale and Hollywood and the New York Times, right? Mm. The Guatemalan immigrants aren't the reason why the New York Times is a left-wing organization, right? That's white people who did that. So, you know, this is the two things that we're connecting here. It's kind of this presumption that doesn't make a lot of sense, right? So illegal immigration can be bad, and yet we can also challenge the assertion that illegal immigration has somehow fundamentally transformed American culture, which it has not. American culture has its own problems, but they're not driven by illegal immigration. They're driven by white leftists.
But doesn't the quantum matter even of legal immigration? I mean, if surely 300,000 people a year versus 30,000 people a year makes a difference, or a million people a year, or whatever. Just choose at some point.
The quantity can matter, and also the mix can matter, right? So if the range of countries from which immigrants are emigrating from is more diverse, or at the very least less culturally concentrated or geographically concentrated, that can make a big difference, right? So imagine, one of the things actually that Australia, I would argue, does really well relative to the U.S. is Australia's immigration system, like Canada's, is a system in which there's a real emphasis on the skills and merit that people bring into the system. And so on a relative basis, compared to other countries, immigration has been less controversial in Canada and Australia compared to, say, France or the U.K., or the US, where immigration is much more driven by random stuff like people just crossing the border illegally, or in the case of even legal immigration in the US, we have this really stupid system where a tiny percentage, under 15% of legal immigration to the US is based on the skills and economic contributions you might make to the US. The vast majority of legal immigration to the US is actually people who are merely relatives of existing U.S. citizens or other immigrants, which doesn't make any sense at all. And that's one thing that the Australian and Canadian systems with the point system that you guys have, I think is something we could learn from. And I'm not the first person to say that. People have been talking about that. Even Trump proposed in 2019 a reform that was along the lines of the Australian system. So yes, first of all, we should have border security. We should crack down on illegal immigration. And we should reform the legal immigration system to be more economically oriented. And if we did those two things, we would move a lot in the direction of having a rational immigration system that most Americans support.
I had a long chat with Mark Krikorian, who I'm sure you know from the Center for Immigration Studies in Washington, and I was it's just amazing to me how out of control illegal immigration is in the United States in a way that just boggles the mind for an Australian. We have a crackdown on that. We don't have that same problem. But then I'm always wary of people praising the Australian points-based immigration system too much, as Boris Johnson and some of the people in America do, because in the last 2 years, we have had the population of Adelaide come to Australia, and it is a real issue now, the scale of mass immigration in Australia. And look, we don't have any of the same type of animosities that have existed in other parts of Europe yet. But, you know, with all these things, you have to be prudent so that you can sustain the kind of easygoing and assimilative type of culture that we've been able to produce in Australia. Because there are limits to that. It's an attractive culture, as it is in the United States, but you don't want to try and push it to breaking point. And also in Australia, look, we have in our major cities, which is probably not well appreciated, you know, Sydney is probably 50% now of population is born overseas. 30% of Australia is born overseas.
That's a high number, a high percentage.
That is a lot. I mean, even in the UK, I was chatting to someone from the UK early in the week, and she was saying, oh, geez, I didn't quite appreciate that. And again, it's coming back to this earlier idea, you know, everyone, different people from parts of the world can definitely come and become Australian as they can become American. But I just think you have to be prudent about it. Otherwise, you lose what you've got, or you risk changing the culture in such a dramatic way that, you know, future people can't assimilate to it in the same way their parents or grandparents once did. We're running a little bit short of time, but I just wanted to cover quickly, immigration is one. I read that National Conservative Statement of Principles, and we've linked to it on our website as well, just to show people what's going on. And I've been in touch with the different people in the NatCon movement globally. And I've read your Freedom Conservative Statement of Principles as well, and I'll drop it in the show notes afterwards. But I actually thought the NatCon principles was a little bit wordy and overly academic in some ways, because if you're really boiling it down to it, it's trade, immigration, and foreign policy are the three key distinctive areas where the NatCons are different to, you know, Reagan-esque type of conservatism. And we covered immigration. Trade, you know, I spent a lot of time in China. Do you think, and free trade sounds great, but the difference, do you think, like, 100% manufactured goods from China should be able to be imported into the U.S. duty-free? Is that...
China doesn't engage in free trade. China engages in state-sponsored mercantilism. Mm-hmm. And we've been stupid in basically allowing that to be part of the free trade system. Mm-hmm. It absolutely should be much more carefully scrutinized and controlled and restricted. Mm-hmm. And plus... when it comes to national security, there are a lot of elements of national security that we've been until very recently complacent about when it comes to both Chinese involvement in the U.S. defense supply chain and vice versa, their ability to engage in industrial espionage to steal American secrets. So there's lots of things the Chinese are doing that are not above board. And it was a huge mistake to give them permanent normal trade relations in 2000, if I'm getting my years correct.
That's the one I was there.
Terrible idea. Now, the problem with the nationalists in the U.S. is like that there's broad consensus. The freedom conservatives and the national conservatives, I think, broadly agree that we should be much more scrutinizing of China and China's maleficent activity in the world trade system. Now, that's fine. But what the NatCons want to do in the U.S. is say, let's slap a 20% tariff or a 10% tariff on everything that Australia sends to the U.S. and what Canada sends to the U.S. and what the U.K. sends to the U.S. Now, why are we doing that? Are these our geopolitical enemies who are trying to undermine American culture and American values? No, they actually are our great allies and people who are advancing our values around the world. Why are we slapping tariffs on them? And that's the part of the nationalist economic agenda that's hard to understand. What we should be doing is having free trade with allies and being very careful when it comes to state-sponsored bad actors whose intention is to undermine that network of alliances. And that's the difference between a realistic pro-free trade approach, where we say free trade with free people in our statement, versus what the nationalists have leaned towards, which is just across the board tariffs, which, by the way, invite retaliatory tariffs from the other side. So they carry a lot of economic risk. And you know what you hear a lot of NatCons say in the U.S. is, well, get over it. You people who believe in free trade and Americans in general need to get over their addiction to cheap stuff. Mm. And you know, there's nothing more elitist than a group of people making six-figure salaries saying to ordinary working Americans that they need to get over their, quote, addiction to cheap stuff, unquote, when ordinary Americans are struggling every day to make ends meet with the paychecks that they earn. And so I find it quite ironic that national conservatives claim to be populists when their core economic agenda will result in making most goods and services in America much more expensive than they already are.
Yeah, I mean, it's a big debate. I remember I had a chat with someone senior from Heritage, and they were saying, oh, look, now we have, unlike the NAFTA debates where we were very much, free trade, we have now tempered our view and have changed and listening to people like Robert Lighthouse. And it was just very interesting because I do remember distinctly in 2000 the attitude with China's accession to the WTO and the rest of it, of the American multinationals and think tanks and the rest of it. And it is interesting how times change. I mean, look, I think the NatCon types would say the closer you are, you know, culturally and politically, the more closer type of trading relationships you should be able to have. But it's not just China. It's, you know, the third world labor is... in some ways, free trade is just an excuse to sort of outsource jobs to those places. And you have to, you know, there's a reason why J.D. Vance's Ohio ended up the way it did. And that wasn't simply because...
Yeah, that's the argument. But you know what? One thing that's interesting, if you delve into actual data and not anecdotes, is that in America, we have a massive labor shortage in manufacturing. You talk to anyone who actually runs a plant, and what they'll tell you is finding workers who will show up every day and not fail a drug test is extremely hard. And the NatCon response is, well, just pay them more. And the plant managers say, we are paying them more. Wages have gone up a lot, and we still can't find people because we massively subsidize people to not work in America. And that's a big problem.
And that's not something the NatCons are really talking about. They're claiming that the real solution to all this is more tariffs. And I'm afraid it's not. I'm afraid that what you're going to see is 10% across the board tariffs will dramatically increase the cost of living for Americans. It will not disproportionately harm China. In fact, if anything, it might reward China because you're harming our allies who might otherwise provide competitive products to the Chinese market. The end result is those manufacturing jobs that you thought you were protecting will still go away because, you know what, if you put a massive tariff on everyone's steel production, including from our allies, that makes it hard for American car companies to manufacture cars at a competitive price because the steel they have to buy has become more expensive. So what are they going to do? They're going to move their automaking plants to other countries where they can buy steel at a cheaper price. So you're actually driving the manufacturing jobs out of the United States because you're putting a tariff on a critical commodity. So this is the kind of economic illiteracy of the protectionists that, again, we should all look very carefully at the bad practices of a China. But it should be very careful before we massively distort the system that has done so much to provide a lot of manufacturing jobs to the United States. And yes, we should ensure that more manufacturing jobs are possible in the U.S. One way to do that is to reform and roll back workplace and environmental regulations that don't actually protect workers or the environment, but simply make it more expensive and less competitive to manufacture goods in the United States. I would love for NatCons to spend a lot of time on that. Unfortunately, they don't.
And the other one is foreign policy. I don't think in the Freedom Conservative Statement of Principles, there was as much focus on that, right? I mean,
because we have a statement that's, I believe it's a 10th of the 10 principles. We talk about how American foreign policy should serve the just interests of the United States, first and foremost, and that American leadership of the world serves American interests. But we leave some room for the robust debate that there always is in intra-conservative circles between people who have an absolutist isolationist point of view or non-interventionist point of view, depending on what term you prefer, or a more Reagan-esque, prudential, leader of the free world type approach to American foreign policy.
Yeah, I mean, you could read that statement as being, you know, we need to support Ukraine to the hilt and continue to do it, or you could read it as we need to be much more focused on U.S. Interests, and or at least, like you said, it gives scope for a much more of a debate to that. It's not prescriptive. It's in the West, some of the other sort of statements.
I think the key thing that we were trying to where we were trying to lay down a marker in our statement of principles was that American leadership really does matter. The idea that we can just be another country and just look inward and not care about how our allies are doing, that we should actually ignore our alliances and it really doesn't matter if there's war elsewhere. No, actually it does matter. Particularly it matters to our economy and our the prosperity of our citizens. It matters that there's free trade and that there's peace around the world. And to the degree that we can promote stability, and American leadership has promoted stability and peace in general in this post-World War II era, that's a good thing. It's good for other countries to respect the sovereignty of their neighbors. It's good for other countries to respect the sovereignty of their citizens and the freedom of their citizens, and that American interests are served when more countries respect each other's sovereignty and respect their own the freedom of their own citizens. And American leadership plays a constructive role in that. And I think what's unfortunate about the NatCons is there's been a kind of an overlearning of the lessons of Iraq. It's sort of like, well, we screwed up in Iraq, therefore America should never care about anything that happens anywhere else in the world ever. And that's kind of an overcorrection, right? And Reagan didn't invade the Soviet Union. He did defeat the Soviet Union. He cared about defeating the Soviet Union. He cared about liberating Eastern Europe, but he did not invade the Soviet Union, right? So it is possible to have a constructive foreign policy that does not involve invading other countries. And I think the NatCons, and this is a generational thing. I think a lot of people who are millennials and younger who weren't around for the fall of the Berlin Wall and didn't directly experience that era of constructive American leadership are too cynical of the constructive role America can play in the world.
Final question, because I know I've kept you a while. Is there anything that you've changed your mind on about the National Conservative movement, or anything you've taken from it, which has you've thought, look, they have got a point there. This is something that hasn't been given enough consideration in the past, and something that is worth thinking through again.
Look, I spent my 20s, I misspent my 20s, my parents would say, chairing the Conservative Party of the Yale Political Union and debating the first principles of conservative thought going back to the ancient Greeks all the way to the modern day. So I'm very aware of the paradoxes in classical liberalism, the arguments from capital C conservatives against classical liberalism. And so there's nothing new under the sun, as you pointed out aptly earlier. And so there's nothing really surprising to me about these debates. I think those who are new to them on the NatCon side ought to have the humility to recognize that these debates have been going on for a long time. And vice versa for the classical liberals. They should also have the humility to recognize that these debates have been going on for a long time. So no, I wouldn't say there's anything particularly surprising about these debates. I would say that empirically, the strength of the argument is on the classical liberal side, because it is classical liberalism that has produced the wealthiest and most powerful and most peaceful countries in the history of the world. And nationalism has not. Nationalism has, at its extremes, produced violence and death and pestilence and destruction at its extremes. And of course, all good nationalists will say, well, we're not those kinds of nationalists. We're the good nationalists. And I get that. And there is a constructive and positive form of nationalism. But the most constructive and positive form of nationalism is one that incorporates as much as possible classical liberal principles.
Good. Well, at the very least, in defense of nationalism, I don't hope that Trump sets his eye on Australia in the same way he seems to be setting his eye on Canada, because we like to be just chart our own course and make
too far away. We can't buy you.
Well, you know, who knows how the future will play out, mate. Hey, I really appreciate chatting, Avik, and making time for us. And I'll encourage people to follow your work and drop all in the show notes, because I think it is a very constructive and you're someone who has, as you say, been in the trenches of these intellectual debates for a long, long period of time. I'll leave you to it. I've got to fly, but go well.
Well, thanks for waking up really early to do this with me. And I have not been to Australia. I hope to visit sometime and meet you in person.
Great stuff. And I always think it's actually very informative for Americans to come, because they often have very sometimes utopian notions about what it's like, or they think it is Texas with a different accent, and it's not quite that, but it has very, very many positives. Tucker Carlson was out here recently and had some interesting things to say. I'll leave you to it. Thanks again, Avik. Bye.
Thank you. Appreciate it.